You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On today's show, Andrew Zimmern from Bizarre Foods. Zimmern stopped by the studio a couple weeks ago. He talked about that time he hung out with Prince. He nonchalantly mentioned how he plans to run for office one day. Talked about some of the not safe for work situations he's gotten himself into while filming Bizarre Foods around the world. And wait, speaking of not safe for work, we also check in with Bon Appetit's Emil Stonick and Brad Leone, our resident fermentation enthusiasts, and we hear about some of the food experiments they're getting themselves into in the BA kitchen these days. So right now, here's Andrew Zimmern and me. Let's give a listen. So Andrew, you marched in here this morning to One World Trade Center, and you immediately went to our test kitchen to pull yourself an espresso shot.
It was the opportunity was offered to me.
That's true. You didn't just barge in here. Because
that sounds – well, there are people who do what I do who I imagine barge in to places like this and take it over. And that's not my style. But once offered the opportunity to go to the test kitchen, I wanted to. Then I walked downstairs and there was the La Marzarco, you know, SP2000. And
is that literally what it's called? Or did you just
No, I just made that up. And there's in typical, but it is true. Italian design is very unique. They have lots of bells and levers and whistles, but nothing, their wayfinding and signage is really shitty because the Italians are like, no, if we put a little white arrow or a little word that says push, it affects the design.
Yes, it's definitely form over function in Italy.
Correct.
So before you got on TV and before you're one of those guys who I've always known without ever knowing, but you're like, oh yeah, Zimmern, the guy on TV. But you worked in restaurants before you got on TV.
Yeah. Now that I've been on television pretty much for 11 years straight, there's a whole generation of people that have no idea that I spent 20 years in kitchens at great restaurants all around the world, and I miss cooking. So I take every opportunity that I can to go in and cook something for other people. And in fact, the TV thing started because I insisted on traveling, sometimes just going for 2-3 days to the Philippines. I mean, it was just sick schedule. Take an extra day off from the restaurant that I was working in.
Which is what year? What restaurant?
This is a bistro, a French bistro that I was a partner in Minneapolis that's long since closed. But at the time was the best restaurant in Minneapolis, I thought. And
did other people concur?
Some did. several restaurant reviewers, some serious eaters. We did some really cool things.
And what year are we talking?
1993, 1994, 1995, 1996. And I would tell these stories to my staff about the places that I went and the things that I did. And eventually that became the kernel of the idea that said, you know, Sign, I want to do that to a larger platform. Mm-hmm. And I picked TV.
Wait.
Yeah.
First of all, because one doesn't just pick TV. There's a lot of people.
Why not?
Well, there's a bazillion people who want to be on TV. They don't ever get on TV.
Well, this is 1996. Okay.
This is not like 1896. Still, there's, you know.
But in 1996, TV and food on TV was not what it was today.
No.
So I looked downstream at you know, all alone one night, you know, lying in bed, not being able to sleep. And I said, I want this platform. The biggest platform there is at the time was television. And I had this mission. So I tried to sell this show about telling stories about food through culture, preaching a lesson of tolerance and understanding with other people around the world. And I was kicked out of every office that I went into.
Okay, but had you done TV at this point?
I'd been on a couple shows. I'd done a couple things. But it's why – and I knew I would be good at it, but it's why I quit – sold my partnership in the restaurant, quit my jobs, and took a 3-month internship at a radio station, a magazine, and a TV station in Minnesota because I wanted to learn. And I thought maybe I'd have a better – maybe I'd be good – better than I thought at the magazine thing or the radio thing, and maybe that – because I needed some insurance if the TV thing didn't work out, because who says I'm going to have a TV show and then gets one?
No one does. One question. I think nowadays – obviously, food TV is a huge thing. Young people see Zimmern on TV. Maybe they see Anthony Bourdain and think to themselves, oh, I'd like to do a show like that, but with yada, yada, yada.
Everybody wants to.
When you were at that age, was there anyone on TV who you looked to as an inspiration or thinking that you could riff on what they were doing?
All of them, but none of them were doing the show I wanted to do, which is why I thought it would be successful.
Are you talking about food people or
early
news people? Or?
I mean, remember, Graham Kerr was still on television. Justin Wilson was still on TV. In reruns, Justin Wilson was still on TV. Jeff Smith,
Frugal Gourmet.
And Serial Pederast was still on TV.
I'm going to let you say that.
You're an important guy with an important job.
You're the controversial one.
I'll handle all the negative discourse. All the Food Network people were coming. You know, this is 96, 97. So you had, Bobby was on there. Mario was on there. Sarah was on there.
Not yet, though. Not in 96.
96, 97?
Oh, really?
Sure. 20 years. Food Network just celebrated 2 years ago their 20th anniversary.
I guess so.
And then there were a couple of, like, Rick Steves was just starting to make travel television. And I wanted to marry those two things because I had spent a life traveling. I mean, the one thing that guys like Tony and I have in common is that we actually have lived and do live our brands. Mm-hmm. We're the same people on camera as off. We've always done what we do. If the cameras stopped rolling, Tony wouldn't leave the bar or the restaurant or the conversation with that person because he's legitimately interested in what you see him doing on TV. I'm the same way. I mean, the crew packs up the van and then they come for me last and they're lucky if I leave.
But TV is exhausting. Filming TV is, it might seem glamorous, but it is a taxing
Oh, it's horrible, and it's horrible for your life and your lifestyle and your health and your wellness.
Because for that half hour of a show, there's many, 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 many hours that go into that.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, however, I have several shows that are aired in 73 countries, and so the opportunity to make a point about something that I believe in is worth all of that.
Okay, so though, you had a clear idea in your mind, relatively clear, about what you wanted this show to be or what it could be.
And couldn't sell it.
Yeah, how do you communicate that to someone else who doesn't know you, doesn't have a visual to refer to? What ultimately tipped the scales and convinced someone to say, let's do this?
I lied.
Oh, that's good.
So one of the tools that ended up bringing me down in my addiction and all that life was living a falsity, you know, not being who I was, not being true to myself. Today, I work very hard to be hyper honest and hyper real because I don't want to go back to that horrible stinkhole that I spent many years crawling out of. However, some of the things that we learn on the streets come in really handy. So I was in these rooms and I realized I couldn't sell the show that I wanted to sell because they weren't looking to buy that. And so I put a hook around it, which was, you know, fat white Jew from New York goes around world, eats bugs. And the minute I kind of put that as the lead, everyone was like, well, now that's amazing.
There you go.
And I knew, because I knew enough about television, because I'd worked in it for a couple of years on the local level and I'd started to do other people's national shows and, you know, stuff like that. I knew in a talent obsessed, because by this point we're, you know, 13 years ago, I knew that while the networks thought they were important and while production companies thought they were important, the only thing that was important on television was who was doing the talking.
Yeah.
And I reasoned that I could make whatever show these people wanted. And that after a year, if it wasn't successful, I'm off television. Great experiment failed. And I would be okay because I had faith that everything would be okay. But if it worked, I would have the leverage to twist the show's point of view just a couple of degrees every season. And eventually, and it happened faster than I anticipated, but eventually I could make the show that I wanted to make, which is an entertainment show, but one that has a very, very serious message. And
so let me ask you this. You just gave
that's
me
what
the,
I make.
You gave me the one sentence elevator pitch that got you the show many years ago. What's your one sentence pitch for what the show is now?
Bizarre Foods is a show that tells stories about culture through food, the point of which is to get people to stop practicing contempt prior to investigation in their lives.
Which would never have gotten sold if you said that.
Well, ever.
Ever. Food, culture, race differences. Mm-hmm. A lot of talk about that recently. Dan Pashman over at The Sporkful, fellow podcaster over on WNYC, had a series about, is this food racist? Mm-hmm. Something that Eddie Wong talks about a lot, about cultural appropriation. As a self-described fat white Jew traveling the world to other cultures, how do you grapple with that as someone sort of going into other people's worlds, and how conscious of you are that of that sort of debate are you?
Well, I'm very conscious of all of it. I don't start with that premise, though. The first thing I start with is that I'd rather be a better guest than anything else. The second thing I realize is that in many situations, I mean, I go to a show about fancy restaurants in Paris. Who gives a shit? I mean, that's easy. You roll the balls out on the court and you let, the star dunk the ball. I mean, it's easy. When I go into a tribe in a tribal region in Africa, or I go into the most violent favela in Rio de Janeiro that's run by an international narco trafficker, you have to take very, very seriously how you present yourself. So number one, I want to be a good guest. Number two, I want to make sure that I'm telling their story, and I want to make sure that I'm still being true to the story that I'm trying to tell. So I'm not thinking about cultural appropriation. I'm trying to present their way of doing things and how they do things.
Who sets that up? Who lays the groundwork?
Well, we wanted to shoot in this place called Jeppy's Hostel, at the time the most violent and awful place on planet Earth. A lot of arms dealing went on outside of the place. That neighborhood, even the army doesn't go in. Well, they go in every couple of years and quote-unquote cleanse it. There's a lot of gang violence and stuff. But there's a group of Zulu grandparents that are trying to preserve Zulu culture. Remember, 120 years ago, to put people to work in the diamond mines and the platinum mines, these big European companies went into the tribal world in the country that is now South Africa and took several tribes and literally wiped them off the face of the earth and put them into bungalow life in these townships and put them to work as slaves in the mines. So there is a large part of Zulu culture, in particular, being one of them, the Zulus who've tried to preserve their food, their dress, their dance while living in these buildings under control of these European companies. Well, not a lot has changed despite apartheid ending and despite a lot of the issues of 120 years ago disappearing on the face of the earth. The undercurrent is that these people are still trapped there with no upward mobility. So if you want to seek out Zulu culture, you can't do it by going to the tribal area, because in the tribal area, there's a whole bunch of Zulus who have found a living that when the tour bus comes up, they all put on their native outfits and play some music and do some stuff and then sell some trinkets. The same thing in the favelas, the same thing in many parts of the world, in the Ngorongoro crater. I mean, we see this. So a lot of shows go and they do what I call the Disney World Maasai or the Disney World Zulu. If you want to experience the real thing, you have to go where the real thing is. And sometimes that's a little dangerous. And sometimes you have to go through certain levels. So we knew where these people lived. We knew what was going on in Jeppy's Hostel. And when we went and scouted with our security people and stuff like that, we said we just got out of the van. I mean, you got to have some balls at a certain point. Yeah. And you walk in and you tell them that you want to tell stories about their food and their culture. And you would be amazed. I mean, even people who spend their day ruling their city block with a machine gun and a machete are like, oh, my gosh, you want to tell a story about our culture and our dance and who we are? Nobody else has ever been interested in that. No, they're always interested in my gun and my machete. Yeah. In the favelas in Rio, when people come from greater Amazonia out of the jungles with foods and food styles that no one in the cities has ever seen before, and with by the way, fruits, vegetables, fish, meat that nobody has ever tasted before, or food styles that people haven't tasted before, they can only afford to live in these favelas. So they go to live. So if you want to explore the roots of those foods from those native peoples, the first peoples of Amazonia, you have to do it in these slums and favelas. So the international narco traffickers, once you find them, I think it took our fixer, our producer, our security people, and then when I arrived on the set, me going in there day after day after day saying, please, 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 please. You know, I didn't sit there and pass judgment on the narco trafficker. I intimated he's a bad person doing the wrong thing. However, there's a Robin Hood element to this. He runs a city, this particular favela that we went to. It's 400,000 people. He supplies electricity, water, and rule of law, you know, police there. And he provides a safe place for these 400,000 people to live.
Doing episodes like that and the internet being the internet, you mm-hmm. must get a lot of comments and criticisms and people bitching or badgering at you. How do you decide what to respond to, what not to respond to?
On my Twitter feed, Instagram feed, website, there's so many comments. I don't get a chance to see all of them because they're just whizzing by so fast. But when I do check them and I see something I don't like, I call it out. I mean, right now, and it's happening everywhere with all personalities about politics.
Will you call it out just to that person, or will you make sure that everyone sees your comment?
I make sure everyone sees it. Because that person who's saying something is actually speaking for thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people who are seeing the thinking the same thing. I just believe in what I believe in, and I believe in my right to say it. So if somebody takes a shot at somebody who's a friend of mine or puts down a people or a race or makes a negative comment about a food, or to get back to the original intent of the question, doesn't fully understand this notion of appropriation and culinary racism, or what I think it's more ethnocentrism. I talk about it a lot.
Mm-hmm. But I find it so hard. What bothers me about Twitter, and I'm on Twitter all day, it's almost impossible to get into a nuanced conversation someone. It's just people yelling at each other in 140 characters, and it's these very blunt, aggressive commentary, and it's not a discussion.
Well, those are all the trolls. And that's why I like Facebook and Instagram and Pinterest, and I get something out of each of them.
All right, totally shifting gears. Where were you when you heard that Prince died?
I was actually in the mayor of Minneapolis's office.
Really?
And by complete coincidence, there's a project that I'm working on. It's no secret to anyone who follows me that I'm very into politics and want to run for office when my whole TV thing is done locally in Minnesota. And the mayor, Betsy Hodges, is a good friend of mine, and there's a public works project there. And I sent her a note that said, unless you get food people involved in this right now, it's going to be a disaster. So she said, great, come down to my office. So I grabbed a couple of chef friends of mine. I said, let's go down and talk to the mayor about this thing. And we walked in, and some of her assistants were saying, no, you got to wait, you got to wait. She's dealing with some stuff, but her office is all the way at the end of the hall, and she's a friend. So I see her waving me in. So we walked in, and I was told that Prince had died. And I checked my Twitter. It was amazing. And watching the mayor of Minneapolis, you never realize what a mayor has to do. The extra police on certain streets, permission to keep First Avenue open 24 hours a day in perpetuity until the mayor decided no, so they could do these all-night dance parties for free on the streets, providing security, turning all the lights in the city purple for, you know, putting the lights on the bridge and making the purple, all this kind of, and just hundreds of other issues, what to do with security around Paisley Park, falls under her purview.
Was she emotional, or is she too besieged by all these issues she had to deal with, even have an emotion?
Both. I mean, she's a lifelong Minneapolitan, mm-hmm. and she's a little younger than me. She's the Prince generation and grew up listening to his music. I think that her professionalism engaged immediately, and she was dealing with this as you would want to see, you know, a quarterback in the last minute of the Super Bowl down by five, driving down the field. I mean, I was so proud of my mayor watching her deal with a very, very tough thing in the face of something that really shocked a lot of people. You know, we don't have many folks in Minnesota that and we have Garrison Keillor, we got Al Franken, Kevin Garnett got traded, you know, Joe Mauer's got the bad knee. I mean, it's awful.
You're kind of the guy now. You're next man up.
really scary. But the amazing thing to me is how much Minnesotans treasured this person. And now Paisley Park is a couple miles from my house. And I'm not going to lie to you. There aren't that many people like me that live in the Twin Cities. So I'm talking about like TV folks, blah, blah, blah. So yeah, you know, there's not some secret cabal of celebrities in Minneapolis, but there ain't that many of us. So I've had my nights at Paisley Park and gotten
so you met him.
And you know, I mean, he went to a small church there. He was involved in the community. He supported local musicians. He like lived in Minnesota. He brought all his recording stuff to him. I mean,
big
when
sports,
you think about
big sports
it,
guy also.
Loved. I mean, just an amazing. I mean, strangest guy I've met in a long time, but an amazing, amazing love affair that he lived with his city where he grew up and never left.
That's what's so fascinating. The fact that he didn't live in Bel Air or something.
Right. People in Minnesota and not even part of the time. I mean, he was there in the winter.
What did you do at his house when you went? What tell me one story. What would happen at Paisley Park?
Well, there were, I mean, famously he would have these parties. And I went to my share of big ones where, you know, the security people come up to you and whisper in your ear if you could come with us, and you end up, you know, 25 people in another room.
But what was going on at the party? Just kind
of
like
hundreds
of
people,
food and drink and dancing.
Food and drink. I mean, he'd be serious vegetarian, oftentimes not food, just beverage. You know, great music playing. He would come out and do some songs. He would introduce a lot of new talent at these parties. But the, you know, the great thing for me was one night being there, and he came in, and I forget which. I don't think she was right after Sheila. Sheila had left. This is probably 12 years ago, and he had that all girl band that he had put together, and he just came in. There were maybe 100 people in the room, and he just played for 2 hours just because he wanted to. And I'm sitting there, you know, 8 feet away, you know, watching Prince go through. And I, you know, I paid money to go see him in Madison Square Garden when he first started and freaked out. So, I mean, just gentle, cool nights. And he was really a nice guy, smaller than you even thought he was. but he projected an energy. I mean, there's certain people who are just real, I mean, like superstars, that the energy in the room is different when they're in it.
I went back and watched his Super Bowl appearance, which is, I think, by far the best Super Bowl halftime
show.
And it was just magnetic and him up on stage in the rain, playing Purple Rain, the giant shadow. And it's just like, wow. Like, it really is like, you know, raises the hair on your arms.
It was crazy. It was really, I love the Eric Clapton thing after he got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And they said to him, how does it feel to be the greatest guitar player in the history of the world? He said, I don't know. Ask Prince.
Okay. So,
lightning round.
We got to do this. All right. Ready? Either or questions.
Sure.
Yeah. We can do this.
I love this kind of thing.
Eyeballs or testicles?
Testicles.
Any ones in particular?
Poultry. Tuna. Most eyeballs are not fun to eat. Tuna eyeballs are maybe one of my favorite quote unquote organ meats of all time from big tuna. They have so much muscle behind them that is tense like a short rib. It's amazing. Wow. And the fat that's around the eye is better than bone marrow. Wait till people see my Okinawa show. I really dissect, and I use that word loosely, why it's so much better. But yeah, testicles in general, when they're super fresh and they come from, you know, big geese, big chick, big roosters, are absolutely sublime.
Fried?
Fried. I actually like sauteing, dust them in flour, sauteed, and treat them as you would a piece of fish a la Meunier. A little bit of white wine, parsley, and butter.
All right. Vikings or Twins?
Vikings.
Last flight out at night, red eye, or first flight out in the morning?
Red eye. Always. Saves time.
Twitter or Instagram?
Instagram.
What do you like about Instagram?
I like that you can project an image and you can tell a story underneath it, and I try not to exceed very many words. And the evil twist to this is that I have a program on my phone that my IT guy put on, so all of my pictures go directly onto my Twitter account in the form of a picture as opposed to a link, so I get the best of both worlds.
I like that. Minneapolis question. Replacements or Husker Du?
Replacements.
Imodium MD or Pepto-Bismol?
Pepto. But I will tell you, I don't really use them.
Penis or placenta?
penis because there's more that you can do with it. Although both are delicious. If more people tasted placenta, they would be amazed. It tastes like liver. I'm done. It has to be fresh. Here's the problem. I would see placenta in jungle markets all over Asia for 20 years, and I never once bothered to eat it because a placenta in a bag, plastic bag, getting hot under the sun, to me was like a trip to the hospital.
Yeah.
But when I was on that farm in Vashon Island in off the coast of Washington, just about an hour's ferry ride out of Seattle, and a horse was birthed, a cow was birthed, I ran to the placenta with my pocket knife because I had never tasted one super fresh, and the cow had just expelled the placenta. So people were kind of shocked and horrified, but I'd waited like 15 years to try one. And when I tasted it, it tasted like raw liver. And I love the Teresiga restaurants in Ethiopia that serve all the raw meat, liver, and you dip it into lemon juice and berberet and eat it. And so I tasted the placenta, and there was a lot of parts of it that were kind of messy, but the main part of the placenta that kind of holds together tastes just like liver. So I'm dying to get another one, slice it thin, dust it in flour, and do like a foie de veau treatment to it so I can see if it holds up under cooking.
Last question. This might be too basic for you, but olive oil or butter?
You know something? I'm going to say butter because butter is back.
Yeah.
But, you know, butter is the new cupcake. It's the new foie gras, whatever it is. I mean, you know, like I love butter. I will say I collect olive oil. I'm a big smuggler. Mm-hmm. And so I just brought back a quart of olive oil freshly pressed from Cyprus.
Hopefully there's no TSA guys listen to this show.
No, all the TSA guys love me because they know that I don't bring back anything that's going to have bad things in it. Yeah. And they all would rather
get a
picture of me for their wife or for themselves than open up my bags.
Yeah. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Andrew Zimmern.
Thanks.
All right, Brad, last time we were here, you had like a fish head and some sort of lab jar thing going on. How'd that turn out?
No, not so good. We were...
What was that again?
I was trying to make fish sauce. It was a method that I looked up on the internet about how you can just add a bunch of different fish and some spices and a little bit of water and then some salt, and you let it go for about 6-7 weeks, and it was pretty much inedible.
I'm pretty shocked that didn't work.
You know it.
You know why? Because it wasn't Bon Appetit tested and approved. Found it on the internet. I just did air quotes, and see, that's what you get, Brad.
Recipes.com.
I mean, it wasn't. I tasted it. You know, nothing bad happened, but it certainly wasn't. There was no reason why I would use that over like just a store bought fish sauce.
What is your favorite store bought brand?
I like Red Boat a lot and Squid. Yeah. Ooh, yeah.
All right, so what do you got going now? What's your first subject, so to
speak?
Yeah,
so something I'm really, really into now is making my own vinegars. Because, you know, in the kitchen, we test with a lot of wines, and we have, you know, we'll use champagnes for cocktails and stuff, and there's a lot of leftover.
I was like, well, it's 4 o'clock. Let's just do a test of champagne cocktail here in the test kitchen.
More like 9:30 in the morning. Yeah. And so there's a lot of, like, you know, half bottles of stuff. So I put them into a big glass vessel with a little bit of a vinegar mother, which is... You know, like if you ever have Bragg's apple cider vinegar and there's that little bit of it, it almost looks like a white little disc floating in there.
That cloudy stuff at the bottom.
It's just a bunch of cultures that have combined to, you know, come together and formed a solid. But it's all those live enzymes are in the vinegar. So if you add some of that to a different wine, in this case, red wine or champagne, eventually, you know, in a few months, it becomes vinegar. And I started fooling around with different blends of sherry. And my favorite right now is it's Creek Beer, which is a red ale that's aged on oak with cherries. And I mixed that with red wine, let that go for about 2 months, and it came out. It was fantastic.
So you can use the same vinegar mother for all kinds of different vinegars? You don't need to have like a red wine vinegar mother, a white wine vinegar mother?
I think you should. I think they are different. I think for red wine and white wine, I think they are. I've used both, and it seemed to have worked. But I do think that if you were going to continuously do it, that I think that there are two different types.
I think what's interesting about these projects, and whether it was your ill-fated fish sauce or on the flip side, the vinegar, you said it was sherry and craft beer, sort of?
Yeah, there was one was a sherry, which was by itself. And then the other one was red wine and creek beer.
Creek beer. And what's interesting, like, you don't know for a couple of months whether or not it's going to be good.
Oh, yeah.
Right? You just got to be patient and trust.
And you taste it along the way, and you start getting excited, and you can tell if it's starting to go south or not.
Yeah.
But these just really worked out.
Well, so with something like vinegar, and if you're doing it this home, which doesn't at home, it doesn't seem that difficult, but how do you know when it's ready?
Just by taste. You just constantly taste it. You can dip a little straw in there and just taste a little sample of it. And when you get that right acidity level, mm-hmm. you know, I like it real bright and acidic so that I can just use a little bit of it. Or, you know, for salads, like just real simple, a little salt, a little pepper, a little olive oil, and just a little spray or a little, you know, a little drizzle of the vinegar.
Well, when it's ready, is there anything to do to stop it fermenting or whatever?
Yeah,
or
is it, you can take it. So what I do is I drain it. That's a good question. I take it out of the jar, leave the mother in there, and bottle it, and then I keep it in the fridge.
Oh, cool.
Or just keep, you can keep it at room temp, but then it will continue, it will start to, it'll form a new mother and start to go more.
So how come there are some vinegars that you buy at the store and they're at room temperature and you store them at room temperature, but your vinegars you need to refrigerate or bottle or they'll keep on fermenting?
Right. I mean, I'd have to look at the labels in some of them. Some vinegars might be pasteurized.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I know some aren't, like Bragg's, and that is a raw vinegar, and that will continue.
Yeah.
I mean, it gets to a certain point where it'll plateau,
right.
and eventually the yeast and the bacteria will die, and it won't become anymore.
Because those yeast and bacteria are eating alcohol, right?
So when it runs out of food, it will hypothetically stop. But if you want it to keep going, you can keep feeding it a little bit, or it'll just go until it runs out of food.
Gotcha.
All right, Emil, what do you got going on?
Well, inspired by all of the kombucha making that Brad has been doing, I was remembering that in the first book on fermentation that I ever read, Wild Fermentation by Sander Katz,
when you were like six years old,
I was, you know, I was maybe like 14 or 15. He was talking about how, you know, kombucha is normally made like a fermented drink made from tea, sweet tea, and then like this big blob, this kombucha mother. And he was saying, you know, you can really make it with anything that has sugar in it. You could even make it with Mountain Dew. And so I was looking at all of the kombucha making that Brad was doing, and I was like, we should try to make some kombucha with Mountain Dew and Coca-Cola. So we bought a couple of liter bottles of soda, put it in a jar, put some mother into it. And
where did you get the mother from?
From Brad.
Yeah, we sacrificed some mother.
Mm-hmm.
Very big of you.
But so, I mean, these are almost two weeks old.
Yeah.
So I think they're ready to taste.
Right, so we got little Dixie cups. The Mountain Dew still looks like Mountain Dew. It doesn't change color?
No, apparently not.
And it tastes like Mountain Dew.
Well, the SCOBY won't eat food dye number yellow 5 or something.
It tastes slightly fermented. It tastes a little bit different.
I'm going to go with slightly. What, Brad, if you let this go longer, will it get more fermented tasting, or will it still just taste like Mountain Dew?
I mean, it took me a little while to have me get, you know, behind this with any kind of enthusiasm.
Brad's like, Brad's just officially, he's not endorsing this project.
Should we try the Coca-Cola?
Let's try the Coca-Cola.
Let's, please.
That definitely tastes more different.
That tastes, yeah, it tastes different.
And it might be something that has to go a little longer. I mean, there's so much stuff in it. I don't see why it wouldn't work.
I just think Mountain Dew is invincible.
Yeah,
it's like the government, the military probably uses Mountain Dew for special ops.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is the thing. It's like, you know, I'm not trying to make kombucha out of these things necessarily, but it's cool to kind of push the boundaries of that and see like what you can ferment that way, and then, you know, figure out what the limits are. And it feels like commercial soda is maybe kind of right on the edge.
All right, Brad, what do you got next up?
Yeah, so another one I've been fooling around with is I was making regular miso paste, which is,
you know, no big deal.
Well, I was fooling around with that, but I got into fooling around with some, we had a byproduct of making nut milk. One of our food editors, Rick Martinez, was making different homemade nut milks from cashew and pecan, and there's a byproduct of that, which is like a real fine pulp.
Okay.
It's the fiber and
after you press all the liquid out.
After you press all the liquid out.
So it's like sawdust but made out of nuts.
Yeah, it's more pasty.
Yeah, pasty.
And I added that with koji powder, which is just an inoculated rice. It's one of the main ingredients in making miso.
Okay.
And you add that and you mix it together and you put it in a glass jar and you put a weight on it. And this one doesn't need to go as long as traditional misos, which are like 6 months to a year.
Why not?
I think some of the properties in the nut start to go rancid and get a little weird.
So in a good way or bad way? I'm like, I don't know with you guys. I don't know if that's a good thing.
Rancid's never good.
So how long did this go for?
These went for about 2.5 weeks, and it started to smell kind of like alcohol. And it tastes a little tingly and nutty and good, and I didn't get sick, but it's
I love how the litmus test is I didn't get sick. Yeah, right, right.
There's like good, yeah. There's really good, yeah. And then on the other side, there's like,
well, I didn't get sick.
I mean, it's a beautiful color.
So can I see? What do you mean a beautiful color? That's like grayish. What is that?
Oh, it's beautiful. What it's is like beautiful about chocolate that? And mocha and
yeah. I don't know. Can I see it? Can you slide over here? So he's got a ball jar. It looks kind of like a, yeah, kind of a beigey, grayey.
Yeah, give it a smell.
Paste.
Whoa.
It smells nutty, but a little fermented.
A little funky.
Nutty, yeah. I would.
You could taste it, too.
So what are you going to do with this?
I'm not sure yet. Maybe.
It's very fluffy, almost. I thought it would be more dense, like clay-like.
And maybe mix it in with a little soup or a vinaigrette or some kind of marinade. Uh-huh.
It kind of gives you that umami boost. Yeah. If something needs a little kick in the pants.
It's weird enough. You add it and down. So maybe put that on like some fish or a marinade or a dressing.
What were the nuts that you used?
A pecan and cashew.
Okay.
So I will not get sick if I taste this.
No promises.
No promises.
You probably have a strong gut.
Well, this one sings the nostrils.
The pecan is so sweet.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And there's no added sugar. It's just the koji, the nut, and a little bit of salt.
All right. So Brad hasn't killed anyone. Emil, what about you?
So one thing I started a couple of months ago and kind of forgot about, I think I saw this on like Melissa Clark's Instagram or something, but couldn't find any recipe online for it. But it was whole garlic cloves in honey. Mm. And so it's just, I mean, what I did was I just peeled a bunch of garlic, put it in a glass jar, and then poured like a jar of raw honey over top of it and put a little salt in, put like a, you know, dried chili in. And a little bit of water to thin it out.
Wait, why the salt?
You know, why not?
Why not? And why the water?
Just because I really wanted to make sure that all of the cloves were going to be submerged. Mm-hmm. And they weren't going to, because at first they were kind of floating. But after, you know, about a week or two, the garlic cloves had really given up a lot of their liquid into the honey. And so you had this honey that was really kind of garlicky, a little bit spicy, a little bit funky. And it was, you know, it's fermenting because it's raw honey and it has live cultures in it. You had this honey that was just like really sticky, sweet, garlicky. It's really good on pizza.
Yeah.
Really good drizzled on just some meats or mixed into like a kind of barbecue sauce or a wing sauce. Mm. And then you can also eat those whole cloves if you just mash that up on a cracker or...
See, this is making me hungry, Brad. Now we're talking.
We did a hot honey pizza here at Bon Appetit. We did. Cast iron pizza. You can find it.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Brad, and that's your video,
I might
right?
have done that, yeah.
Brad Leone. He just raised his hand. You can find that at bonappetit.com. It's a cool sort of like cast iron skillet pizza.
Yeah, with a drizzle of like, it's chili honey.
Yeah.
But this set would... just bring it to another level.
Why not throw some garlic in there?
We're going to get some going.
All right. So I want to taste that next time. Brad, you got one more. What do you got?
Yeah. Another thing I'm going to start doing tomorrow. I've done it before, but I just want to start hanging them here, is you get some mushrooms. I mean, I start with shiitake or maitake, and you hang them anywhere where they can pick up some natural sunlight. And you can
You used to have all these chili peppers hanging from your dish rack here. What happened to those?
Well, they hit their sweet spot. And I
again, how do you know?
It's just by touch and by feel. Uh-huh. You want them to be a little pliable.
Feel like dried chilies.
Yeah. And then from there, you can put them in a bag and you can keep them in the freezer and they'll stay fresh for when they can just pop them out whenever you need them and they come right back to life perfectly. Little flavor bombs. And you can just keep them in the freezer and pull one out when you need it. And
Bamba.
Yeah. But now I'm hanging the mushrooms, especially it's just really, you can keep them in the freezer as well for up to like 6 months once they're dry. And you want them to get dry, completely dry. And just hang them in sunlight. And mushrooms are one of the only things that we can get vitamin D from other than the sun. So when you dry them in the sun, they actually increase in their vitamin D content because they soak it in from the sun as they dry. So you want to hang them where they have exposure to sunlight. And they'll go from, you know, vitamin E, like IU, which I think, what's that stand for? International Unit. And it'll go from 4 IUs to like up to 26 to 30 just in the drying process of vitamin D.
So what might you do with the dried mushrooms?
Then you can, good question. You turn them into a powder and you can use them on a rub or you can put them in a braise. You can just take the whole mushrooms and throw them in stock or in soup, put them in rice. I mean, and if you were to soak them back in water, they would reconstitute.
Rehydrate.
Wait, Brad, have you ever smoked? I've been thinking about doing dried mushrooms this summer, but I really want to smoke them. Get like a bunch of them and kind of get like have that to be like the start to the drying process.
That'd be cool.
Like kind of like a light hot smoke.
Speaking of smoking, you have like a. You don't know pizza oven or what's
crazy?
And is this legal?
So, you know, it's like we get emails all day long from people who are kind of pitching their new products. And, you know, a lot of it is garbage. A lot of it is not stuff that we have any interest in. But what really caught my eye is this. Somebody sent me an email about it's a small single pizza wood-fired pizza oven. So it's made of metal. It's all stainless steel. And it's made by a company called Uni. U-U-N-I. It's Finnish. I don't remember what it's Finnish for. But so it's like, it just comes. I called one in.
It fits one pizza?
One kind of like 14-inch pizza sort of situation. And it's fired. It takes wood pellets. So it comes with like compressed oak pellets.
Like the big
food grade.
Yeah. And so you put them in the back. You put a match to it. And then in 10 minutes, the inside is up to 900 degrees.
Wow.
And so you're cooking pizzas in like 90 seconds in that thing. I mean, I haven't tried it yet. I'm going to try it tomorrow.
And you need a peel to get them in and out.
Yeah, it comes with a little peel, but it's pretty small. You know, it's like sitting on my picnic table outside in my yard. And, you know, it seems like it's good for like 5 or 6, 7 pizzas. And then you just throw a little bit more in. But I'm also excited to use it for fish, for whole fish, I mean,
900
for steaks,
degrees, yeah.
You know, you really got a lot of firepower.
What might you throw on the pizzas tomorrow? Do you have any sort of ideas?
Oh, I haven't really gotten that.
Oh, come on.
Yet.
Come on.
I mean, I'm thinking about the garlic honey. I'm thinking about like a spicy sopressata and garlic honey situation. I'm thinking about, you know, kind of the spring greens that we're still getting. And just doing, you know, just tossing them with a little olive oil and like a little bit of vinegar and salt, just putting those on the pizza and letting them wilt.
Nice. What sort of cheeses might you employ?
You know, I mean, I like mozzarella.
Yeah.
You know?
For the listener,
I don't go crazy with cheese.
What kind of mozzarella should the listener buy when they're making homemade pizza?
You know, I mean, they're...
Oh, Brad just raised his hands.
Let's let Brad Leone take that one.
Brad's actually Italian.
I've had really good experiences with just like the block, low moisture, part skim mozzarella cheese.
Not the fresh kind.
I mean, you can go that route, but they tend to leach out a lot of water when you cook them.
Yeah, that's don't ever use, I mean, I love the imported buffalo mozzarella to eat, but that's such a high water content. Yeah.
It's a waste. And it just, it feels like a waste. It's like, I was worried that people are going to make fun of me. I like the compressed, like kind of cheap, part.
Oh, it has its purpose.
Yeah, it's in a tight wrapper and you got to cut it open.
Yeah.
I never would have just
box grated and it, I mean, it works perfect. You get that nice gooiness. You don't get puddles of water.
Right. And then you get your ball of buffalo mozzarella and then you tear it up and put olive oil on it. You eat that for an appetizer.
There you go.
Because you can't have too much cheese.
It's true.
Or carbs.
I am kind of lactose intolerant.
Selectively so. Well, guys, thanks so much for joining. I look forward to our chat next month to see what sort of dangerous and diabolical things you get up to.
I'm alive.
Yeah, if you're alive. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
This podcast is produced by Belle Cushing and Carrie Polis, with editing by Mitra Kaboli and additional assistance from Christina Che and Lily Sherman. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Greedies. Look for new episodes every Wednesday on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also subscribe to our print magazine, In the Flesh, at bonappetit.com/summergrilling. We have a pretty good deal right now in the spirit of grilling and summer and all that. 3 issues for $5 at bonappetit.com/summergrilling.